In this example, oil is worth nearly 10 times as much as gas.
Lawmakers look at separating oil and gas taxes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 9th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, U.S. senators negotiate climate change legislation.
If you're a Republican and you believe we should drill, baby, drill, now's your chance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Hearings opened in the state Senate this morning on a bill to separate oil taxes from gas taxes, addressing the risk that, taken together, the two resources reduce the total revenue to the state. Economist Roger Marks told the Senate Finance Committee that the tax value of oil far exceeds the tax value of gas.
On a straight BTU to BTU, apples to apples basis, in this example, oil is worth nearly 10 times as much as gas. So what is driving this bill is what ensues when you combine two substances that have vastly different values.
Calculations from legislative and administrative economists put the cost of combining the resources at nearly $2 billion a year when gas and oil prices are similar to the current market conditions. Separating the two taxes has solid support in the Finance Committee and strong support throughout the entire Senate. However, there is objection to decoupling, as it's called. House Minority Leader Beth Krutula says there's reason to worry that dealing with the bill will turn into a complete rewrite of the state's tax regime.
I am not, and I remain not, concerned about the statutes as they are. I think that this is truly not a necessary step. If we could come up with a compromise on decoupling alone, on separating an oil and gas tax, then that might work. But that is not what I see happening, and I don't think it will happen.
And Anchorage Democrat Berta Gardner says the energy sources naturally go together.
When you're talking about our net profits tax, they also have to separate and allocate the costs of producing in order to work the tax system, and you know, the resource comes up all mixed together. So how do you say? And you know, there are obvious advantages to doing it one way or another depending on the circumstances, and the state would have very little control.
Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman, who is the principal force behind the decoupling move, says the Senate is aware of concerns about the possible expansion of the committee's intent, and he recognizes the bill will need some technical work to avoid those problems. A Republican senator negotiating climate change legislation left a White House meeting today saying now is the time to act on energy policy. South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham has been working for months with Democrat John Kerry of Massachusetts and Independent Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut on a bipartisan climate change bill. Graham said this evening outside the White House that comprehensive legislation can create jobs, diminish dependence on foreign oil, and improve the environment. And he wants members of his party to get engaged.
If you're a Republican and you believe we should drill, baby, drill, now's your chance. If you're a Republican, independent, or Democrat that believes in nuclear power, the store's open, now's your chance. And I hope every American would pursue cleaner air. Don't let this moment pass. Don't water down a chance to transform our economy.
Graham was one of six Republican senators invited to the White House by President Obama. Senator Lisa Murkowski also attended, but she avoided talking to reporters afterward. She has not put out a statement commenting on the meeting as of airtime, even though she was the only member of the Republican leadership team there. The closed-door gathering also included several cabinet members, among them Environmental Protection Agency head Lisa Jackson, with whom Murkowski disagrees on EPA regulations. Seven Democrats and the independent Lieberman were in the room, too. All the senators invited were considered key to the current climate debate or are swing votes. Maine Republican Susan Collins told reporters on the way out of the White House that President Obama says he still wants Congress to pass a climate bill this year. But many hurdles stand in the way, including whether emissions should be capped and whether a carbon trading system should be set up. Senator Graham supports carbon pricing and says he wants a broad bill rather than a piecemeal approach.
I've said it pretty bluntly. I'm not going to support a half-ass energy bill, because that's what it will become. It will become a watered-down energy bill where we can go back home and say we did good things. And the truth is, we'll go back home and we're no more independent of foreign oil than we were before the bill passed.
Graham and the other senators say the White House didn't lay out details of what it is willing to put on the table, but independent Senator Lieberman says all sides will have to compromise, including the White House.
You know, when the three of us got together, we all agreed that to make this happen for the country, every one of us had to leave our comfort zone. And as the president reminded us today, he left the Democratic comfort zone in his State of the Union when he came out for more support for nuclear power and more drilling for oil and gas in America. And of course, what we hope for in return is support for some of the other programs that have traditionally been of concern to people who are Democrats or even independents.
Lieberman, Kerry, and Graham say they're working on an offshore drilling component to their bill. In the meantime, Alaska's delegation is waiting to hear what direction the administration actually takes on offshore development. Officials have said they are aiming to announce new drilling policies in the coming weeks, which could greatly affect Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iditarod frontrunners leave Nikolai.
It's an exciting race. Everybody is talking about how tight it is and what strong challengers are at the front of the pack.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Iditarod frontrunner Sebastian Schnula was first into Nikolai this morning at 9:47 with just a hair more than a half-hour lead over Mitch Seavey. AlaskaDispatch.com reporter Jill Burke is in Nikolai, and she says after Seavey, a string of familiar names came in.
Then Jeff King, John Baker, Hans Gott, Hugh Neff, Lance Mackey was just another person behind them. And so we're seeing some real strong veterans and hungry veterans make it in and kind of chase each other as they make their way towards their mandatory 24-hour layovers. The sun has come out, so after some bad weather getting here, it's been a beautiful day in Nikolai. The checkpoint's been busy. Mushers are taking a break, regrouping. Some of them are napping, and a lot of them have enjoyed a hot lunch here at the school.
According to reports direct from the top of the Kuskokwim School in Nikolai, Schnula, King, and Baker have left the checkpoint and are on the trail to McGrath. Schnula and King are still running 16 dogs, Baker 15. Burke says mushers reported glare ice conditions leaving Roan with windy, bumpy conditions. Zach Steer reported that some snow that arrived made the going a bit easier.
That having been said, you talked to Lance Mackey. He had some struggles. He had some bumpy moguls coming into Squintna. He thinks that that trip roughed up a couple of his dogs. He had to drop one already 100 miles into the race. He suspects he will be leaving two behind here in Nikolai. So he could very well be departing Nikolai with a team of 13 instead of the 16 he started with. So I don't think that makes him very happy, but it's a challenge, and Mackey always likes a challenge.
King and Seavey are posting fast travel times of more than 9 miles an hour. Hugh Neff and Sven Haltman, both into Nikolai, are also moving fast. Four mushers scratched today at Rainy Pass. Michael Supernaut, Zoya Denur, Karen Hendrickson, and Kirk Barnum left the race early this morning. Barnum was down to 12 dogs and cited the health of his team as his reason. Hendrickson said she had a damaged sled, and Supernaut and Denur cited medical reasons for leaving the race. 8 Canadians are driving dog teams in the iconic race to Nome. Some say that's a little less than 10-1 odds that it could be Canada's year to win the coveted first place finish. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Hans Scott did more than win the Yukon Quest for a fourth time this year. He beat Lance Mackey. The 51-year-old musher and Iditarod veteran from Whitehorse now heads to Nome and the fabled Burled Arch. But will he and his team get there first?
Oh, I think there's a lot of people out there other than Lance. Well, of course, you know, he's a three-time defending champion and the Iditarod. But I think there's at least seven, eight more teams of that caliber out there to compete with.
Gott says he's retiring from long-distance races now that he's matched Mackey's 4 Quest wins. But not until after one more Iditarod.
I'm feeling very good about it. I have 13 of the 14 Quest dogs here, so it's pretty much the same team. So very familiar team.
And let's not overlook Gott's 3rd Quest accomplishment. He also shaved a full day off the Quest's previous fastest finish. Gott's 9-day and 1-hour finish was almost 23 hours faster than the 2009 Quest finish time posted by that year's winner, Whitehorse's Sebastian Schnüle. Oddsmakers are taking a hard look at that speed. Gott beat Mackey by a little over an hour this year. Online bookmaker Pinnacle Sports has given good odds to the Canadian mushers in the past. In 2009, Pinnacle placed 16-1 odds that Gott would finish the Iditarod in first place. Gott placed 10th last year, one of 2 Canadians to finish in the top 10 in the 2009 Iditarod. That's an all-Canadian 20% of the best 10 teams. Sebastian Schnüle claimed 2nd place in Iditarod 09 right after his Yukon Quest win that year. Pinnacle gave Schnüle 21-1 odds of winning the Iditarod. This year, Schnüle says with a typical grin, Gott could be the one to beat. Schnüle took off in Anchorage wearing a Hans Scott autograph on his forehead.
It's so I don't forget he's there.
Iditarod spokesman Chaz St. George says there's a ton of talent among the Canadian mushers. Canadians have been moving to the front of the race for some time.
Yeah, I hope we all move up until we can't move any further anymore, at least one of us. You know, I think Hans especially has a shot at the first place, and Sebastian's definitely going to be right around there somewhere, and I'm hoping to show up in the top 10. Hope we'll all be there. You know.
That's Whitehorse musher Jerry Willemitzer. An Iditarod rookie in 2007, Willemitzer finished in 24th place last year.
I've done a few quests as well that adds a little bit of 1,000-mile race experience. I mean, this is my 9th 1,000-mile race. And I've looked at the history of top Iditarod contenders. Everybody took 7 or 8 attempts before they started moving into a consistent top performance level, you know, so I should be there now, you know.
Iditarod veteran Warren Palfrey from British Columbia finished in 19th place last year and says he's confident about his chances this year.
Yeah, this is to be the 4th now. Every year we've been improving, so we're looking to crack right into the top this year.
Canadians Hank DeBruin, Michelle Phillips, Ross Adams, and Karen Ramstead are also running this year's Iditarod. Iditarod Eye on the Trail blog claims that it will all be played out on the trail, and to try to second-guess a winner this early is fruitless. There are 30 teams that could make top 20 and 15 teams that could be in the top 10. And maybe 10 mushers could win the coveted first-place spot. And the Iditarod blog goes on to say that Mackey won 3 out of 8 Iditarods. That's pretty good odds there. Mackey says he's got his eye on the prize.
What is my greatest strength? Determination. What am I looking for? A new truck.
Pinnacle Sports posts on its website that wagers on Iditarod winners and losers are determined based on the official finishing positions provided by the Iditarod Trail Committee. The official Iditarod rule on that score, it's the lead dog's nose, not the musher's rear end, that determines first place. Gentlemen, place your bets. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Race updates are at alaskadispatch.com, and pictures, video, and more audio can be found at our website, aprn.org. Officials say the state's renewable energy fund, created just 2 years ago, is already starting to reduce the use of oil and gas to generate electricity in Alaska. The state legislature created the fund in 2008 and has put $125 million into it during the first 2 years. That money has gone to fund two rounds of grant awards for 107 projects around the state. So far, five projects funded by the first round have been completed, including a hydropower plant in Gustavus and a wind project in Kodiak. The projects coming online are already reducing diesel and gas energy generation. The Alaska Energy Authority's Peter Krimp says that displacement will grow in the next few years as more projects are finished.
Our estimates are that about 1 million gallons displaced diesel equivalent this year. By 2011, we think that figure will be up to 2.5 million gallon equivalent per year. And then by 2012, for round one, about 5.8 million gallons of diesel equivalent. When I say equivalent, that means because some of the projects displace natural gas on the rail belt, for instance.
Krip says AEA expects completion of another 46 projects in 2010. Interest has been high for the state grant money. In the first two rounds, the state received 233 applications for projects totaling $766 million. In the latest round, still awaiting legislative approval, utility companies and municipalities submitted 123 requests for $223 million worth of grants. Krimp says the AEA has received applications for technologies that are still being developed, like tidal energy projects. However, he says for the most part, they have been considering grant applications for already proven technologies.
You know, things like biomass-fired boilers or hydroelectric or wind diesel systems, for which we have pretty good operational history. Things like hydrokinetic. We've dealt with kind of on a case-by-case basis and, realizing that there is some move afoot for separating out emerging energy technologies for kind of separate funding or allocations. And that's being considered in the legislature now.
When they created the fund in 2008, legislators intended to appropriate $50 million per year for 5 years for renewable energy projects.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. To learn more, search ANSEP on the web, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Scientists believe they have pinned down the period that polar bears diverged from the southeast Alaska brown bear population. It may be as recent as 150,000 years ago. Researchers published their findings last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Charlotte Lindquist of the University at Buffalo says there's always been uncertainty about the origin of the species.
All the way from, I think, about 50,000 years to over a million years that split had occurred. But I guess the prevailing thought was that the origin of polar bears had not happened that long ago, and that the polar bear as a species is fairly young in evolutionary terms.
Lindquist says the breakthrough came with the recent discovery of a polar bear jawbone fossil in Norway's Svalbard archipelago. Since polar bears primarily live on sea ice, their remains are usually scavenged by other animals or end up on the sea floor.
Since the fossil record of polar bears is very poor and the fossils that are existing have been discovered are much, much younger. It's just a few thousand years old and very few that are older than 10,000 years old. So finding a polar bear fossil that is perhaps up to 130,000 years old was just remarkable in itself. And then that the DNA was so well preserved in such an old sample, allowing us to sequence by far the oldest mammalian mitochondrial genome to date, that was a surprise.
Lindquist and her associates at the University of Oslo and Pennsylvania State University compared the mitochondrial DNA of the Svalbard jawbone to present-day polar bears in Alaska. They also examined the DNA of a Kodiak brown bear and three brown bears from Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof Islands. Lindquist says another big surprise was the discovery that the ancient Svalbard bear died shortly after polar bears and the brown bears from the southeast Alaska population diverged about 150,000 years ago. That's near the end of the second-to-last ice age during the latest Pleistocene era. Even though the early polar bear could adapt to those previous warming and cooling trends, Lindquist doubts that the species, as it exists today, could survive a significantly warmer climate.
The ancient bear probably lived in an Arctic environment like polar bears do today. And it seems that the polar bear today is very specialized to that Arctic environment. And I would really question whether the polar bear, the species we know it today, would be able to adapt to future climate changes. What my guess would be is that they would then perhaps be confined to areas where there would be environment and habitat suitable for polar bears that are so specialized to this Arctic environment.
Polar bears are genetically more distant to other species. The Kodiak Island brown population appears to have diverged from the southeast bears nearly 500,000 years ago, when the connection to American black bears goes back 2.5 million years. Two avalanches closed down portions of the Seward Highway in south-central Alaska today, although a section has been reopened to Girdwood. Places still remain closed at airtime as road crews work to clear the snow. Outside of Alaska, winter has been relatively mild in the Pacific Northwest. The snowpack in most of the region's mountains is well below normal, but it's still been a deadly season in the backcountry. There are four Northwest Avalanche Centers across the Northwest where forecasters keep an eye on the region's snowpack. Northwest News Network correspondent Doug Nedvornik went out in the field with an avalanche expert in central Idaho.
Dave Bingaman spends at least 4 days a week in the backcountry. He's from the Payette Avalanche Center in McCall, Idaho. His ritual starts with towing his snowmobile to a parking lot. And then he starts his snow machine and drives it down a ramp off the trailer. Today I'm tagging along, so Bingaman unbolts a second snowmobile. I've never driven one of these things before, so he gives me a quick lesson.
Here's your throttle. Okay. Brakes on this side. Okay.
When the lesson's done, he hands me a helmet and pulls the starter. After a practice lap around the parking lot, off we go into the wilderness, which is surprisingly close. Bingaman's mission is to get backcountry amateurs like me to think about avalanches and how to avoid them. After riding on wide, well-groomed roads and then uphill and narrow trails, we get to the top of a ridge. We get off of our sleds and onto our snowshoes. We creep down a steep slope to a spot where Bingaman will test the snow. He opens his backpack and pulls out a little two-piece shovel.
One of the things we do a lot of is digging. What we're looking for is weak layers that are going to cause avalanches or potentially cause avalanches.
Bingaman unfolds his measuring probe and thrusts it into the ground. With a jagged little saw, he carefully cuts lines in the snow to outline his test area. And then he starts digging until he has a solitary column of snow, about 4 feet tall and a foot wide. He lays the shovel on top.
And we're going to apply some stress and see what happens.
Part of this column of snow collapses, and then he gets out a little piece of clear plexiglass, and like Sherlock Holmes, he inspects it with a magnifying glass.
We can actually look at these crystals and see what they are and try to figure out what it's sliding on. Kind of what we do, what we're trying to figure out here.
The prognosis? The avalanche danger on this slope is moderate, about a 2 on the center's scale of 1 to 5, 5 being the most dangerous.
If you decide you're going to ski down below us right here, it's probably fairly stable snow. But that doesn't really hold true if you're on a different ridge or a different aspect somewhere.
An aspect in this case is a mountain slope. Some of the snowpack around here, he says, is far less stable, probably worth avoiding right now. Bingaman logs his data in a notebook. Later, he'll go back to his office and write an avalanche forecast that he'll email to more than 300 people who come to this backcountry regularly. That forecast is also available via the center's website and by phone.
Good morning, this is Dave Bingaman with the Paid Avalanche Center Advisory. Avalanche hazard for the West Central Mountains below 7,000 feet is moderate today.
Later that evening in McCall, I joined Bingaman at an avalanche safety workshop.
So predicting when and where avalanches are going to occur is tricky. Avalanches are an erratic phenomenon.
This is part of a video with footage of snow slides, information about the best ways to avoid them, and what you should do if you're caught in one. The workshop is put on by the Friends of the Payette Avalanche Center. That's a nonprofit dedicated to backcountry safety. After the video's over, the group's Dave Williams gets out the three pieces of equipment he says all backcountry users should carry with them.
You need to have a shovel, a probe, and a beacon. You could either have a tracker, all digital beacon, analog digital, whatever, but know how to use them.
William says that knowledge often means the difference between life and death. He says skiers and snowmobilers should travel in groups and be prepared in case of a snowslide. He says they have about 15 minutes to dig out someone who's buried before that person suffocates or freezes. The message about the danger of avalanches hit home here in December when a snowmobiler was killed by one about 30 miles south of here. Avalanches have killed 17 Americans so far this winter, including six from the Northwest. Dave Bingaman says forecasters like him are using new media to spread their safety message.
If we talk about a particular weak layer and then we show that weak layer failing in a video clip on our site or on Facebook or YouTube or wherever else, it's a good resource for the people that use our services to see, and a learning tool as well.
The record for people killed by avalanches in any winter in the U.S. is 36. That was just 2 years ago. Dave Bingaman says the number of fatalities could be much smaller if people who use the backcountry know how to protect themselves. I'm Doug Nadvornik in McCall, Idaho.
An Arizona company that promised to protect consumers from identity theft has agreed to pay $12 million to settle false advertising claims brought by the Federal Trade Commission and 35 states, including Alaska. Tempe, Arizona-based LifeLock Incorporated has advertised its fraud protection service, promising that it was a proven solution that would protect consumers from fraud. LifeLock agreed to stop saying it protects against all types of identity theft. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Matt Miller in Juneau, and Northwest News Network's Doug Nadvornik in Idaho. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.